welcome back to Silhouettes, a fashion history podcast all about the importance of the clothes we wear. Today, I have the first in a new installment of my short history series, which I know you all really, really liked, and I actually really loved researching, so I was excited to start all this again. You may have read the title of this episode and thought, how is this related to fashion history? However, the mirror, as we're going to be talking about today, I think actually may be one of the most important elements of the development of fashion in terms of how people chose to decorate and style themselves and how they dressed themselves. Because before the invention of a reflective surface, people would have had little to no concept of their individual identity. Before the mirror was even invented, people would have struggled to actually see themselves and know what they looked like, which is quite a wild thought in the modern day when we are so used to seeing ourselves in multiple different ways, whether that's a physical reflection in a mirror or through a digital screen. The only things we would have had, and this was pretty much across the world for all cultures before polished silver or glass was invented, was water or drawings and paintings done from the perspective of others. And as I just said, some people would have used a basic form of polished glass, polished silver, or polished other metals. But the reflection you would have gained would have been limited, it would have been fuzzy, it would have almost been looking at yourself in like one of those old Barbie mirrors where it was just sort of a bit of shiny silver sticker on a plastic mirror. You can't really see yourselves, you can see a basic form and that's about it. And we might have seen ourselves reflected in our family, so in sisters and brothers and parents, but at the end of the day, that is only a glimpse of our true faces, and so personal identity was probably quite a difficult thing to conjure. Today, obviously, our faces are, as I said, a familiar sight, and we see ourselves almost constantly. Mirrors, really, are what allow us to see ourselves the most authentically, and even that is slightly skewed. But they show us what we look like, they let us examine ourselves, and they can give us a glimpse into our ancestry and our heritage. And inherently, that obviously became important to the history of styling, and therefore the history of fashion. There's no culture on earth that have not used mirrors and do not and will not use mirrors for self-identity and personal styling. We also see mirrors in fiction, in story, in literature and mythology, as well as in a great deal of art. We see reflected images really popular in a great deal of art from the 18th and 19th centuries. And mirrors are also hugely important to science and scientific developments. And as we know, the development of science also affected fashion because it affected things like underwear and makeup and sort of chemicals that people would have used on their hair. So it's all intrinsically linked and it all comes back to the invention of the mirror. Now, according to Vanessa Mead, who is the curator of the Museum of the Home, even going back 500 years, it would have been very unusual to ever see your reflection because glass mirrors were so expensive and only the wealthiest members of society could afford them. They were so pricey, as she says, it is even rumoured that one countess sold acres and acres of farmland just to buy one small mirror. And so self-reflection was a thing almost impossible in the ancient times and difficult even in more recent history with the last few hundred years. So let's start from the beginning. The oldest mirrors known to us now were reflective surfaces made of polished obsidian. And these are based off archaeological records dating as far back as 4000 BCE. In fact, in terms of biblical record, we see representations of highly polished volcanic stones, obsidian, being used. Some pieces even found in Turkey date back to about 6000 BCE. There is also evidence of copper being used to create a shiny mirrored-like surface in Iraq and in Egypt in around 3000 BCE. There is also evidence of mirrors being used as tools for personal styling and grooming dating back to the 5th century, and these are seen in illustrations of Greek women gazing into hand mirrors and doing their makeup, and there are many examples of this. So essentially the concept of a mirror in terms of a shining surface of metal or precious stone that would reflect something back at you, whether that be yourself or something in your environment, dates back to the ancient times, most likely in Turkey or in Egypt. And that makes a great deal of sense, particularly when it comes to ancient Egypt. If you listen to my ancient Egypt episode, you would know that personal styling and self-identity and the way you groomed yourself was extremely important to the general culture of ancient Egypt. So it would make sense that people would require an object to be able to see what they were doing, basically. Obviously, as always, this information is hugely limited, and a great deal of educating guessing has to be undertaken because, you know, written sources don't exist in the same way. But these are the things that have been found, and there you can find images of these in museums and reputable sources all over the internet and in books. Particularly, and a book I drew a lot from for this episode, is a book called Mark Pendergast, and that is A History of the Human Love Affair with Reflection. It's called Mirror Mirror, and it's a great source if you want an all-over rounded view of the history of the mirror. As I found out, the information is fairly limited, but that is a really good source to go to if you want some more detailed information than I can give you in a short histories episode. A lot of the sources I found on mirrors were either the science of how to create a mirror, the chemistry of it, or on scrying or mirror gazing. And obviously that is really fascinating and something I'm going to get into a little bit about in a minute at the end of this episode, but it wasn't completely relevant for what I was looking for. So do, if you're doing some more research, be aware of that finding out the actual historical side of the mirror is difficult and takes a little bit of teasing out. But let's go back to the prehistory of the mirror or the use of reflective surfaces. There were also mirrors made of polished copper found crafted in Mesopotamia from 4000 BC. There were also a great deal of stone mirrors found in Central and South America, which likely date from around 2000 BC. But as I said, the very first reflective surface would have been a pool of water, or sometimes this would have been water collected in a vessel like a bowl or another object that could hold water. And so it is likely that people used water as a reflective surface in a very primitive sense, and this slowly developed into the desire to create an object that was more practical and easier to use, and developed slowly, or maybe quickly, into the polishing of natural stones such as obsidian. It was in around 6000 BC that people learned to work rocks into weapons, and so obviously precious stones, rocks, and naturally occurring stones were beginning to have more practical uses. In the Mark Pendergast book that I mentioned a minute ago called Mirror Mirror, he actually recites a fable, which is an ancient fable from the African savanna. I'll tell it to you now. An African savanna after a torrential seasonal rain, water still drips from the leaves of the scattered trees and seeps into the roots of the tall grass. In the peaceful aftermath of the storm, animals gather to drink in the temporary pools, lapping and slurping with their tongues. At one pool, however, a creature standing upright on hind legs leans over, preparing to scoop water with its hand, but it stops, furrowing its brow in curiosity. The hominid has noticed how in the still pool, the baobab tree magically appears to grow down into the water. Now he sees a fellow creature looking back at him, hand cupped, ready to drink. Is it an enemy? The hominid bares his teeth, so does the man in the pool. He grunts and hits at him, but the image disappears in a splash. He dips his hand and drinks, then sits back and contemplates the scene before him. The ripples gradually settle and he smiles at the beautiful reflection of the tree, then leans over again to see his silent fellow creature. He too is smiling. Perhaps he is not an enemy after all. The man frowns, so does his reflected companion in the pool. He sticks out his tongue, and they both do. They touch their noses, show their teeth, pull their ears, wink simultaneously. He understands, on one level at least, that they are the same. Yet they are different. Such was probably the first mirror as humans evolved from apes and developed self-consciousness. Of course, this fable is a simplified version of what took evolution millions of years to accomplish. And according to paleontologists, our forebears stretched back some 18 million years and Homo sapiens appeared only some 200,000 years ago. As Pendergast says, our sapient ancestors could think abstractly, use tools and create art. And the paintings of deer, horses, bison and other animals at the Chauvet Cave in southern France were created 32,000 years ago. And physically, we haven't changed much since then, despite our enormous technological progress. And so, it is possible that many of those paintings that we see on ancient grounds could have been self-portraits. And this fable that he retells tells the story of a man seeing his reflection in the water for the first time. And so there is evidence, obviously, here in this fable and in this book, that before mirrors were made of polished copper or obsidian, water would have been used, at its most basic sense, as a reflective surface to see yourself and the world around you. There are also a great many Greek myths that include the story of the mirror in the ancient times in around 700 BCE. For example, the tale of Medusa, who slept with Poseidon in one of Athene's temples, who upset the goddess and who changed her form into a creature with snake for hair who would, if looked directly at, would turn you to stone. And to kill Medusa, the hero Perseus, or the hero as it's told, but obviously now there's lots of retellings of Medusa coming out, which I recommend looking at if you're interested. Anyway, the hero Perseus uses his bronze shield as a mirror to look at Medusa without being turned to stone. There's another myth telling of the story of Narcissus, who was a very beautiful young man, was maimed to punish his youth to fall in love with his own unattainable image. And when he bent to drink in a pool of still water, he saw a beautiful young man whom he took to be a water spirit. But obviously it is himself, and he is so beautiful as to be unattainable, and he falls in love with his own reflective image. So whilst we don't see the introduction of a mirror in the more typical sense, we see reflection as an important part of many of these tales, whether that be bronze shields or pools of water. We also see many instances of Roman women using what is known as a handheld mirror. As we learn in my Roman fashion episode, it was important for women to be seen as beautiful and to groom themselves properly in Roman society because beauty was associated with fertility and virtue. Lucian wrote that she must these days use powders, pomades, paints, and each chambermaid, each slave, carries one of the essential objects for the toilet. One holds a silver basin, another a water pot, still others the mirror. And again, according to Pendergrass, apparently Roman artisans mass-produced mirrors and used a hot tinning process to give bronze a hard, silvery white surface. And this was not only because looking beautiful and self-grooming was important for women of Rome, but also for men too. They were vain, they would curl their hair in front of a mirror, and there was an constant worry in Roman culture of going bald for men. They would use large metal mirrors hung along the walls of public baths. According to Seneca, who complained, "We think ourselves poorly off living like paupers if the walls of our baths are not ablaze with large and costly mirrors." Also, the paranoid emperor Domitian had his gallery lined with polished reflective stone. According to Pendergrass, this was probably white marble or selenite so that he could see what was happening behind his back. So not only were mirrors used popularly in Roman culture for self-grooming, but also just as a reflective surface in general for other means. Also, the insides of some elegant drinking vessels were cut into many faceted mirrors so that the imbiber could see multiple images of himself getting drunk. Because there was hedonistic philosophy roaming around Greek culture about decadence and becoming gluttons for food and sex. So it was important to see your own reflection as you were being gluttonous and imbibing in something elaborate such as alcohol. Now, outside of Greco-Roman culture, there are also many other ancient examples of how important mirrors were to different cultures. And obviously in Greek and Roman, writing was such a popular pastime, and we see many amazing written documents that give us a hint into the history of this part of the world, as like we saw in Mark Prendergast's book and these examples that I gave. But for example, there are many paintings of the Mayans that show how important mirrors were to their culture. Rulers, for example, are frequently shown sitting cross-legged and staring into a reflective surface like a mirror, often held by an assistant. There are also paintings of men dancing with mirrors or just gazing into them. And we obviously know that these are mirrors because the image of the protagonist of the painting, say, is reflected. The use of mirrors in Mesoamerican culture was also closely associated with the idea that reflective surfaces were a portal to a realm that could be seen but not visited. And we see this a great deal in many cultures. In pre-Columbia, reflective surfaces like mirrors were fashioned from flattened stone and served uses in terms of self-grooming, but also for divine reasons. And this can be seen in a great deal of Mesoamerican cultures, from the Maya to the Aztecs to the Purépecha, which I probably said wrong. But mirrors served, as I said, for the Mayans, the terms of seeing oneself, but also the idea of divination and seeing into other realms, which we also see even used today in the terms of scrying, in that looking at a reflection allows you to communicate with another side, whether that be communicating with the dead or communicating with another realm. I know there's also the idea that two mirrors in a room can't face each other because that too opens a portal. I don't know much about the history of that, but I see that a great deal in paranormal investigation stories, or even just in historical sources from the Victorian era, for example, referencing contacting the dead is unsafe, it opens up portals to demons and all this kind of stuff. So mirrors are actually just such an interesting little nugget of history in terms of fashion, which obviously this hasn't been very fashion related up till now, but I'll get into that in a bit. But also just the culture of reflection for various different reasons is so fascinating and something I'd not really given much thought to before. Now, going chronologically, by now what is known as the Bronze Age, we saw many cultures using mirrors made from polished discs of bronze and copper and silver and other certain metals. In Africa, polished surfaces were very popularly used for self-reflection, and also in China, and this is where we see the introduction of something called a bronze mirror. In around 2000 BC, some of the earliest known bronze examples were being produced by a culture called the Kwija. I hope I've said that right. And this was basically just polished bronze that was used as a reflective surface to style yourself. And from these bronze mirrors is when we see in the Roman Empire silver beginning to be used as a polished surface for the mirror, like I mentioned a minute ago. For the wealthy, there was also a metal called speculum that began to be used to create a mirror. But these were extremely expensive, hard to produce, and were only owned by a certain small percentage of people in China and India. And this obviously was all before the invention of glass, which we forget is really quite a new technological advancement in the history of the world. It wasn't until the first century CE that glass began to be made and slowly became turned into mirrors or use of the reflective surfaces. Glass blowing also grew in technological advancements, and this allowed for a great deal of changes to happen in the way things were made. For example, the Roman scholar Pliny the Elder explains that glass mirrors were produced coated with gold leaf or lead. As he says, the metal provides good reflectivity and the glass provides a smooth surface. And this would have protected the metal on the back from scratching or tarnishing, which is probably one of the main issues that people face with metal mirrors. They would have had to have been polished frequently and with very specific chemical alloys, because as we know, you use certain chemicals on metal and it will just absolutely change the colour or the reflectiveness. Look at what happens to copper if not treated correctly. So it was with the introduction of glass that mirrors would have grown in popularity and been much more available and widely used. However, although there is very little evidence to be sure how truthful this is, and there is, from archaeologists that I've read, a great deal of educated guessing, but glass was introduced in around the first century, and there is written evidences of glass being used as reflective surfaces in the Roman Empire. So you sort of have to do a little bit of putting two and two together. It was likely during the Middle Ages, a few hundred years later, that glassmaking technology really grew, and glassmakers in France made flat glass plates through blowing glass bubbles, spinning them rapidly to flatten them and cutting rectangles out of them. And slowly, better methods began to develop in Italy and Germany, where cylinders of solid glass was blown and the ends were cut off, sliced along its length, and rolled onto a flat hot plate. As we know, also, Venice is now famous for its glass making, and so it makes sense that these technological advancements in the use of glass would have started in Venice. Especially 16th century Venice was a centre of production of glass and eventually mirror glass using a specific technique that was developed in Italy. And that is when a special gilding technique developed in which these flat glass plates were coated in a reflective tin coating made of a type of tin mercury. And this was evaporated by heating the piece of glass, which would fuse it to the glass, creating what we know as a modern day mirror. However, a man named Justus von Liebig is also credited as inventing the modern day mirror in Germany in 1835. Yet, as we know, highly decorated gilded mirrors made of tin alloy and glass were popular before this, but he was the one who really created the silver glass mirror that we know today. He was a chemist, and his wet deposition process involved a thin layer of metallic silver reduced onto glass to create silver nitrate. I hope I'm getting that right. I am not a scientist. The silvering process was adapted for mass manufacturing and created what we know as today's mirror. However, as I said, Venice and Italy in the 1500s, France later into the 1700s, were also centres of the mirror industry before this. However, he just introduced a better way, basically, of creating a silver reflective surface. The V&A actually holds a huge collection of mirrors from the 1700s, which shows that these were really popular and widely used by those of the upper classes with money in the 1700s, typical examples of the Baroque style. And this flourished in late 17th century Italy. This was at a time where self-decoration was really fashionable, particularly in France and Italy, with fashions being elaborate and detailed, including makeup, accessories, and those huge wigs that we know and love. Of course, as we know, the upper classes would have had people helping them get ready. However, it's still an interesting trajectory to trace. We see an era in which the scientific developments of a reflective surface becoming a mirror that we know today, and an era where fashions and makeup and self-decoration was growing and becoming even more elaborate. According to the V&A, monumental carved and gilded mirrors, usually placed above the console tables, were a fundamental element of Italian Baroque interiors. During the day, they helped to magnify the effect of daylight from the windows, and in the evening, they reflected the glimmer of candlelight. Although the original location of particular mirrors they have in their possession are unknown, it's likely that they would have been hung above console tables against a wall of a stateroom. We can still see this in Italian interiors today, for example, in the gallery of the Palazzo Colonna and the Palazzo Doria Pamphilj in Rome. Hope I've said those right. And we see here mirrors being used for self-decoration reasons. For example, the V&A hold a mirror in a rectangular frame of black stained wood composed of several panes of glass painted in polychrome oil paint. The seven panels are painted with a symmetrical design of flying putti, cherubs, holding up swags of flowers and leaves, with gilt foliage and scrolls. At the top of the centre panel is a painted coat of arms, and below a crest helmet, three quarters of the size, surmounted by a coronet. The arms are of the Doncon family of Barley End, Bedfordshire, but it is likely that the arms were added later to the mirror. And this is a mirror that would have been likely made in Italy, but used for a family in England, where, as we know, fashions were also highly elaborate because they had evolved from France and Italy and made their way over to our little island. But if you look on the V&A's website and you have a look at their collections, they hold hundreds of mirrors from this time period. And it shows just how popular the idea of self-reflection was to this group of people in Europe. And this is also where we see societally the development of a self-awareness of your appearance and a great deal many more rules put upon people in terms of what was appropriate for men and women, for example. And I don't think that that trajectory is unexpected, or even much of a coincidence. Because as we know, in the 1800s, society really developed a sort of awareness of themselves and a self-consciousness and a rigidity that we see even today, but particularly through the 1800s and the early 1900s. And we also see the introduction of different types of mirrors throughout the eras. In the Roman and the earlier periods, they were smaller handheld mirrors. But as mirror making became more popular, we obviously see large room size mirrors coming into play. So not only did you see a very small version of your face on just some polished brass, which, you know, as I said at the beginning, wouldn't have been a very truthful reflection of you, but full-sized, body-sized mirrors that would have shown you to yourself in the context of where you were. And I imagine to some people that might have been a bit shocking, particularly as we know portraits were created as a sort of perfect reflection of the individual. They highlighted the best parts, they removed the parts that maybe should have been removed, at least to the time period's points of view. And so a lot of people may not have seen themselves in this way before, so well reflected and in such a large scale. And this is when you see wealthy individuals endorse mirrors in publications and in newspapers in regards to things like social etiquette, household decor, and how to hold yourself and the right fashions to wear. And this is also where we see the introduction of the word vanity really come into play. Obviously, this is a word that has been used in the past in that it was a bit sinful to be vain, and particularly in the Roman times, you had to be gorgeous, but you couldn't be vain. But we actually see the word vanity start to come into play in terms of the physical creation of a mirror. The term vanity mirror replaced the term dressing mirror in the 1700s. And even today, many dressing tables can be called vanity tables. And I think that's a fascinating trajectory to follow, particularly when it comes to the social expectation and experiences of women. According to the Met, in an article called Metropolitan Vanities, the History of the Dressing Table from 2014, It was in the late 17th century in Europe that the form of vanity as we know it today really began to develop. European high society began commissioning luxurious specialized furniture from craftsmen and furniture makers that were engineered to reveal vanity mirrors and additional compartments with which to self-groom. There is an example of a vanity table made for Madame de Pompadour in her chateau overlooking the Seine. And here they say the history of vanity begins and develops into other beautifying paraphernalia, including jars for cosmetics, flasks for perfumes, exotic oils, and mirrors in lipstick tubes. And this is particularly in the 20th century with the Art Deco period. I definitely want to talk a bit about the handheld travel mirror, because this is really an interesting development in this original idea of vanity, in that we must carry a surface with us at all times, particularly in terms of lipstick, to make sure that we did not look wrong or nothing had changed place or our lipstick hadn't rubbed off. And we just see the development of women being ruled by their physical appearance. And the travel mirror is a really interesting way to trace this. You cannot have a hair out of place, lipstick smudge, nothing. You must carry your mirror with you at all times to be able to fix any ills. And lipstick was obviously one of the things that could have gone wrong, because it gets smudged, you're eating, you're, I don't know, there's wind sticking to your hair and things like that. And so you see in the 20s, travel lipstick being held in specialized tubes that had small mirrors attached. And there's many, many examples of this all over the internet. People collect these lipsticks. You can find them on Instagram. But if you just Google mid-century travel lipstick, you'll see hundreds of images of what I'm talking about. It's something now I always carry in my bag, and it's something I've never even considered, but it is this idea of self-vanity and women particularly having to look right and not having anything out of place. But also, if we're seen to do it and we're seen fixing ourselves and we're seen being vain, which has usually been attributed to something negative, then, you know, that's bad. And we care too much about the way we look. So I think there's a really interesting trajectory here where we see the mirror being both a positive thing in terms of people being able to finally see what they look like and have a bit of self-worth and self-identification, but also it naturally for women becoming a slightly more negative thing and something we are slightly ruled by. And so I think in terms of fashion history, it is something really, really relevant, because the handheld mirror became almost an accessory within itself. However, I do want to talk now a little bit more about the idea of self-identification and reclaiming yourself and your self-image. Because we see here the importance of mirrors to a group of people who were desperate and are still desperate to reclaim a sense of self, having this stripped from them in the most basic human level, and how this potentially affected their desire and need to own and create mirrors. And we see mirrors a very popular, important item for enslaved people of colour in the 19th century. For example, using late 18th century Virginia Store accounts, Anne Smart Martin, who is Chipstone Professor and Director of the Interdisciplinary Materia Culture Programme, has found that, among other items, enslaved African Americans were purchasing mirrors. Mirror glass has been found at numerous 18th and 19th century slave sites in Virginia. And this is something so fascinating to think about in the history and the trajectory of self-reflection. As I said, these were a group of people who had themselves ripped away from them. And so reclaiming a little part of their self-identity was probably hugely important to keep your spirits alive and to have a bit of ownership over you and who you were. A writer called Rebecca K. Schramm has an amazing book called In the Looking Glass, which is all about the story of mirrors and identity in early America. And she has a whole section on the African-American slave trade and their connection to mirrors. She actually has a chapter 3, called Looking Glass Ownership in Early America. As she says, in 1832, the American Providence Exploring Company sent the big Aguinoria and its 17-man crew to explore the River Niger in Africa and trade for a wide variety of goods. It carried thousands of items to exchange for these desired goods, including iron, cloth, soap, rum, tobacco, umbrellas, knives, and mirrors. And in fact, the mirror supply consisted of 1,500 pocket looking glasses. And at first glance, as she says, this provides us with a surprising amount of information about mirrors aboard a 19th century American merchant ship. The nearly 2,000 mirrors included among the trade goods suggests that this item was in demand among West African consumers, as it would have been unlikely that an item would have been included if there was not an established market for it. And although these mirrors were not necessarily destined for consumers in America, the Aguinoria traded its goods among African populations from whom millions of men, women, and children were captured and forced into slavery. And so an interest in this item suggests potential familiarity with and a similar interest in mirrors among people enslaved in North America. As she says, ownership of mirrors among African Americans cannot be quantified. The aggregation of archaeological evidence is beginning to provide some interesting data. And there are apparently 297 pieces of mirror glass recovered at 18th and 19th century plantation sites in Maryland, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. And these pieces of mirror glass were recovered from structures associated with African Americans at about 52% of the plantation sites in this archaeological archive, which is the Digital Archaeological Archive of Comparative Slavery. There were also mirrors found at the Portici Plantation, built in 1820 in Virginia, and this was destroyed by a fire in the Civil War. The 19th century slave quarters, known in project reporting as Structure 1, had three fragments of silvered glass, with the archaeologists noting were probably from a small hand mirror, likely owned by slaves. The remains of the plantation house cellar, which is where enslaved workers lived, contained 44 fragments of mirror glass, and the findings from the material culture associated with the planter family's portion of the house included 974 fragments of mirror glass. And these archaeological remnants document mirrors in African American dwellings. They don't tell us how they were acquired or accessed, but the popularity of mirrors in West Africa in the earlier centuries, so in the 1600s and 1700s, indicates that people of African descent would have grown up with mirrors being popular, most likely. And also, enslaved men and women had three main avenues for the acquisition of goods. For example, mirrors could be supplied by their master, acquired through the internal economy, or gained illicitly. But it is also likely that many were traded or acquired as gifts. John Michael Vlach observed that enslaved men and women acquired goods over time and passed them down. Since generations of slaves were raised in the quarters, there was necessarily an accumulation of artifacts. Free people of African descent could similarly acquire mirrors as gifts by purchase or through theft or the generational transfer of goods. But nevertheless, mirrors were a hugely important part of the life of enslaved people for the most part, particularly in the 19th century. A dwelling in North Carolina shows that the slave owner supplied a cheap looking glass for each slave dwelling on his plantation, as he hoped it would increase their feelings of goodwill towards him. His intention of improving the slave and unifying him to his owner worked, at least from his point of view, who noted with satisfaction that a marked change for the better among his slaves happened. However, there is examples of people of African descent buying mirrors, even enslaved people. Enslaved men and women could be involved in the internal economy or gain access to money through some other efforts. They could become active purchasers of material goods, and much of their money was spent on acquiring mirrors or reflective surfaces. Account books reveal that enslaved men and women purchased looking glasses at local stores, and a historian, Anne Smart Martin, found that among the enslaved population who frequented John Hooks's store in late 18th century backcountry Virginia, inexpensive mirrors were popular and were sold at affordable prices for enslaved people. So clearly we see a popularity in the buying of mirrors and objects that could reflect yourself. And I see a lot of writings that suggest that this is because of a need for self-identification and self-reclamation, and to know who you are and what you look like in order to gain back a bit of your own identity, which I think is really quite poignant and sad and a really interesting story in the history of the mirror. Obviously, it's really difficult to know because information from the point of view of enslaved African Americans is limited, sadly, and a great deal of the evidence we get is from the slave owners, the slave masters, the people that worked in the house, or people that would have visited slave plantations and maybe written down what they saw. For example, a British actress called Fanny Kemble, who visited Georgia in the 1830s, wrote that there was a broken looking glass in a slave dwelling, and the old piece of broken looking glass in the dresser with a piece of looking glass to look in. And these were likely throwaways from the master's houses, in which the master of the house would give the slave a broken piece of glass, whether that was as a sort of weird gift or as a way of gaining some favour, or because they were asked for. It's difficult to know. But nevertheless, there's still so much evidence to suggest that enslaved African Americans had in their small possessions mirrors, and for the most part, these were very highly acquired and owned. And when you think this is a group of people who had very little that was their own, the fact that they owned mirrors in such a high percentage is really, really interesting. I also also learned that the trading of mirrors was hugely popular on the Silk Road. According to UNESCO, the history of mirrors owes beyond just the ability to see ourselves and do our own hair and makeup. And that in regions encompassed by the Silk Roads, mirrors not only functioned as personal styling objects, but were also associated with different funerary rites and played a role in various rituals and some forms of entertainment. In particular, the different shapes, designs, and decorative features of personal handheld mirrors were used to look at one's own reflection, could help chart the aesthetic developments of various cultures, as well as reveal their interconnections and exchanges. There have been found many polished metal mirrors, ornately decorated, and these are a popular trade object exported from China and exchanged along the Silk Road, particularly throughout India. Now, some of these were more reflective than others, depending on where they came from. Some were polished metal discs, and some were more technologically advanced. Moreover, it's interesting to see that mirrors not only functioned as a handheld object with which we can see ourselves, but also encompasses many different cultural ideals. For example, mirror work is a type of hand embroidery that includes attaching small pieces of mirror into fabric. Vogue apparently spoke to designer Abhinav Mishra, who is known for his mirror work ensembles, and they spoke about the origin of the craft and his attempt to make this ancient craft relevant to the 21st century. And mirror work can be traced back to the 13th century in Persia, and made its way to India during the Mughal era. And the use of mirrors and the craft of mirror work, as he says, stems from traditional Islamic beliefs, as the mirrors helped to trap or bind the evil eye, reflecting bad luck and evil spirits away from the weaver. And this links back to what I said about the spiritual use of mirrors and the idea of scrying and connecting you to another realm. So we see this throughout the world in a variety of different cultures and religions, and that's really fascinating to me. But it's interesting here that we see it also connected to fabric work and embroidery, and therefore to the idea of clothing. So without realizing, mirrors, even if they have a spiritual attachment, also have a fashion and self-styling attachment. So this episode has been a bit longer than I planned. It was only going to be a short history, but it turns out trying to encompass the story of something as broad and huge as the mirror is very difficult. But I think it's been an interesting episode, and I'm sure there's a great deal of things I missed out. But it's really interesting to see mirrors be used and created so early on in the history of the world. But with it, we see the development of self-identity, the ideas surrounded with vanity, the treatment of women, but also how fashion, particularly that of the 1700s, become more elaborate as mirrors become better and more popular and more technologically advanced. And this is, I don't think, coincidental. I think it's because you begin to be able to see yourself and see yourself reflected back at you, and you want to carve out some sort of decoration for yourself and physical identity. And so naturally fashions became more elaborate as people had a little bit more control over how they looked because they knew how they looked, if that makes sense. It's a really interesting topic. And again, we see the Romans being extremely technologically advanced and then having handheld mirrors that are likely not massively dissimilar to what we have today. And then it going all the way back to just water or polished bronze again in the sort of Middle Ages. And it's not until the Industrial Revolution that these advancements in the mid-1800s really grow with the introduction of science and scientific developments. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you found it interesting. And I really do enjoy doing these short histories episodes. And I have a lot more exciting episodes coming up. Do keep your eyes peeled. Rate and review the podcast on either Spotify or Apple Podcasts or just wherever you get your podcasts. Please give me a review. I absolutely love reading them. And as always, do head over to my Instagram at Silhouettes Podcast for some images connected to this episode. If you are curious and after you've listened to this, or even now, as you're listening to it, want to have a look at some of the things I've mentioned, there will be physical visual examples over there. But with all that in mind, I will see you in the next one. Stay fab, everyone.